And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
As 2007 begins, so too the countdown to our future. 2006 was a year that acknowledged that life on Earth is changing and that we need to learn about the challenges and learn what to do. Today, we're inviting you to an event that can bring you some of the greatest stories of our wild and scenic heritage by the world's leading filmmakers. Take your seat. The show's about to begin. When your voice of the Earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Each new year is a time for looking back and looking forward. And it's no secret that 2006 was a year of change. Election 2006 sent a clear message that the environment matters, as the media was finally forced to begin reporting on the extraordinary reports of some of the hottest summers on record, of the changes in the oceans that lead scientists to predict that there just may be no fish left by 2050, and old energy policies that unleashed thousands of new oil and gas leases in what once was remote and inaccessible. In 2007, we'll see Americans refuse to see their front yards crisscrossed with pipes and wellheads. The media, but especially film, is playing a role in bringing these stories to the people, whether it be the chilling details of the lives of the emperor penguins in the Arctic, or the cold hard facts of global warming, as told by Al Gore in An Inconvenient Truth. And now, even animated films like Happy Feet bring important messaging about the impact that overfishing has on the animals we are learning to love as we come to know them through the wonders of dedicated videographers, storytellers, filmmakers, and brave new producers and directors who fight to get them shown. That's why I find it so important to invite all of you to participate one way or another in next weekend's Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival that's going to take over the historic mining town of Nevada City, California. We're going to be talking with Janet Cohen, the festival coordinator, during our first segment, then head to the mountaintop creative mecca of Lobitos Creek Ranch as we talk with a legendary player in documentary films, Steve Michelson, about his newest entrees to environmental filmmaking. Then in segment 3, environmental media is gaining momentum and Channel GTV is a kindling point of creativity in this emerging media sector. So it's an hour of film and filmmakers coming up. But first, the news. It was dramatic, at least that's what photos from a few years back indicate. A massive ice shelf the size of Manhattan Island broke free from its 3,000-year-old moorage as part of Ellesmere Island in the Canadian Arctic. Scientists studying satellite photos noticed a huge fissure between the ice bridge and the land, then noticed that within an hour, the massive 9-mile ice island had drifted a half mile off. Scientists generally agree that this is yet another indication of a universal warming trend and may presage future such events. Many were taken by the very sudden break and movement, having assumed such might occur much more slowly. Ice shelves in Canada's far north have decreased by 90% in the last 100 years. Within days of the break, the Ailes ice shelf had drifted 30 miles offshore, raising fears that as such events accelerate, shipping in such areas could become more hazardous. After years of obfuscation, denial, qualifiers, and cautious rhetoric, the U.S. government, through its Department of the Interior, has officially acknowledged that global warming is changing the future of planet Earth, as Interior Secretary Dirk Kempthorne proposed listing polar bears as a threatened species. Kempthorne stated that the decision was based at least partially on the concern that polar bears' habitat may literally be melting. When unspun, the words are translated as, "Global warming is melting the ice." Polar bear populations are declining as overhunting and loss of habitat take their toll. The listing may ultimately lead to regulatory control of factors which contribute to the decline, which of course could include CO2 emissions, the giant invisible monster being blamed for much of our planet's declining diversity, as rising temperatures bring about radical shifts in habitats, seasons, and the populations that have developed over millions of years to live in balance with their natural homes. Some declining animal populations have no apparent explanation at all. Dozens of endangered great one-horned rhinoceros have mysteriously vanished from a nature reserve where they have been introduced in areas around Kathmandu, Nepal. Of the 72 rhinos brought in, 23 were recorded as dead by poaching, and the rest, well, no one really knows what happened. Poachers generally leave the body of the animal, which is killed solely for its single horn, which is worth many thousands of dollars, in the illegal trade in endangered animal parts. The one-horned species has been one of the great success stories, as strict protection, especially in India, brought their total numbers from around 100 a century ago to over 2,500 in recent years. And in another part of the world, China is proposing to lift a 13-year domestic ban on the tiger part trade and institute sale of farm-raised tiger parts to meet the demand by traditional medicine, which uses bones, organs, claws, fat, and blood in a variety of curative admixtures. China claims the addition of farm-raised parts would lessen the strain on wild tigers by meeting these demands. Conservationists, on the other hand, fear that encouraging such trade will in fact increase demand and therefore certainly bring about the demise of the already threatened species. A leading advocate of Chinese tiger farms believes that up to a population of over 100,000 tigers on farms could provide up to 10,000 carcasses from natural deaths per year within the next 15 years. It is, in fact, a controversy that is likely to continue for years to come, as no demonstrable definitive answer has been agreed to. And, following the trends, Australian Prime Minister John Howard predicts that Australia will be aggressively expanding their nuclear industry in the years ahead in order to meet increasing energy demands and to use the vast uranium reserves native to Australia in an effort to decrease their greenhouse gas emissions. With current projections, Australia could have 25 new nuclear power plants online by 2050, producing a third of their energy needs and decreasing their greenhouse gases by up to 17%. The future is still living with a nuclear cloud hanging before us, and decisions such as this will increase rather than decrease as economic, cultural, and environmental values meet in the battlefield of competing strategic wills. And that's the news. So now we turn our attention to the exciting world of films and filmmakers who are spanning the globe to tell the stories of challenge and of victory in our efforts to save the wild and the scenic for ourselves and the generations to come. Well, here it is, 2007, and hopefully this is going to be a terrific year, because last year had some problems in so many different ways. Certain realities began to really hit us upside the head in terms of the future of this planet, whether it be global warming or troubles in the seas and the oceans, troubles with species disappearing, polar bears and others. And what's happened, though, with that has come actually some media awareness, and the message is beginning to achieve some level of critical awareness that things must change. Nothing works better in bringing that message forward than media, and in particular film and video. In just about a week or so, up in Nevada City, California, there's going to be the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival, which is bringing together some of the best media available. And to help us really understand that is the film festival coordinator, Janet Cohen. Janet, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Janet, this is your fifth annual film festival. Why don't you give us a little history on this and how it's growing, and then we'll get into some of the details about what's happening.
Thanks very much. Yeah, we started 5 years ago, and it is a originally a fundraiser, and still is, for the South Yuba River Citizens League, which is a grassroots watershed-based organization up in Northern California. The goal of the organization is to protect and preserve the South, well, the Yuba River and its watershed, a very, very gorgeous and well-kept secret river of Nevada, of Northern California. And we thought it would be a good idea to see whether an environmental film festival would be a popular fundraiser. And I think the first year we had about 25 movies, and we showed on two screens for about a day and one evening. And we were extremely worried whether or not anybody would actually turn up. We discouraged filmmakers from coming because we weren't sure whether anyone was going to actually come and watch the movies. And it was a standing room only event. We had to put on an extra special nighttime session to accommodate all the people who couldn't get in. And basically, we've doubled in size every year since then. Until now, we believe that we're probably the largest environmental film festival in America.
Wow, that's sensational. Well, what does that mean? How many films are going to be screened?
We're showing around 110 movies. There are about 40 premieres of one sort or another, from world premieres to West Coast and California premieres. We have about 80 speakers coming, filmmakers and activists. And we basically take over the town. It's one of those wonderful towns that lends itself to a film festival, you know, sort of like Park City and Telluride. It's a little gold rush town nestled in the foothills of the Sierra Mountains. And essentially, we show movies in five different venues. We have parties going on throughout the town, free opening receptions. We have a wine stroll. Every lunchtime, all the cafes are taken over with chats with the filmmaker sessions, where you can meet the filmmaker and talk more about the issues in their movies. We've got an activist center going on in City Hall, where people will be talking about issues raised in the movies. And we've got art shows going on in 14 different places. I mean, we really intended to take over the town, and we really do.
For people who want to start thinking about showing up, what's the date?
It runs from Friday, January the 12th to Sunday, January the 14th. And they can go online to www.wildandscenicfilmfestival.org. And the schedule's up there, all the downtown events, all the ticket information, everything they need to know is there.
I've talked with some of the people who will be presenting their films, some of the videographers and producer and executive directors. It's an extraordinary event. Some of the best will be there. Let's go ahead and start talking about some of the highlights of the event.
It's always an interesting event because we never know what we're going to be sent and what films are out there. And for instance, last year, the theme running through it was clearly a Native American theme. We had lots and lots of movies about interesting aspects of Native American life and history. This year, there's no common theme. It's really interesting because we have some tremendously wonderful movies, extremely important movies about all sorts of subjects. And when we sat back and thought about them all, we all of a sudden realized that really what was coming through was ordinary people doing extraordinary things, people who were working to save their part of the planet and the place that they loved and the people that they loved. And being extremely heroic about it, people like you and me who really put themselves on the front lines. And we're featuring, you know, almost as a centerpiece throughout the festival, these shorts about the Goldman Prize Award winners who are heroes from around the world. I don't know whether your listeners know about the Goldman Award.
But why don't you go ahead and give that background, because that is one of the most prestigious environmental awards given out to people, the doers on the planet.
Yeah, the Goldman Awards, you can Google Goldman Award and find out about it. It's the Nobel Prize, really, of the environmental movement. The Goldman Foundation gives out six awards of, I think, $125,000 a year to people from around the world. I mean, people who for $125,000 will entirely alter the way they live and work to an amazing degree. People from Liberia who, you know, in incredibly difficult circumstances, risking life and limb to save the hardwood forests and really to bring down a dictatorship. People in Haiti, a man in Haiti who's apparently, I mean, I hadn't realized before I saw this little five-minute movie about this guy. Haiti only has 2% tree cover left.
That's right.
Unbelievable. And he's out there with this mass movement replanting Haiti, again, being threatened with death on a very regular basis. So there are people from everywhere, all around the world, doing extraordinary things, and we're showing films on all of them, all of the last 3 years recipients. And there are another wonderful movie is about two, you know, ordinary I don't like to use the word ordinary, but people like you and me, environmental activists, who are working volunteers for Greenpeace in England, and they were sued by McDonald's for libel, and then went into this enormous 15-year lawsuit that I don't really want to say what happened in the end because it would give the game away. But again, heroic people who stood up where nobody else was standing up and saying no to McDonald's. We won't count out to you. You know, unlikely heroes, two men in Australia, you know, one with a beard down to his knees, you know, a biologist who lives in the outback of Australia, and another man, a park ranger, who decided that they were going to save this little marsupial, the bilby, from extinction. Mm-hmm. And they did. An extraordinary story.
You make such an interesting point that you never know what's coming in, and I'd just be curious about your perspective in terms of, you've been doing this now for 5 years. What's the trend? What's happening? I mean, there's many different ways of looking at nature. One would be from the perspective of just nature itself and its glories and wonders and beauty and grandeur. Then, of course, you have people talking about protecting nature and different things that are happening. And then you have those people who are, as you say, laying their lives on the line. Mm-hmm. Sea Shepherd, for example, Paul Watson and others.
Right.
What's the trend? And also, what's happening in terms of the storyline? I'm just really curious about that. Obviously, people who want to see that can come to the festival. What are you noticing?
Well, first of all, it seems to me that there are just more movies being made about environmental issues, which is great. You know, at the most obvious level, Al Gore's movie, The Inconvenient Truth. I mean, I saw it on United Airlines flight the other day coming across the Atlantic. There's just much more interest in making and seeing these sorts of movies about issues relating to the world in which we live. In terms of how filmmakers go about really portraying their feelings about this, it varies. It's across the board. I mean, we could, if we wanted to, and we don't want to, show an entire weekend of incredibly depressing movies, which would, you know, and make everybody go out and slit their wrists at the end of the weekend.
Right.
Because there are some extremely depressing facts. Mm-hmm. We cannot get away from them. We think we're seeing more movies, or it may be our bias in what we want to show. What we try to show is people doing something about it, because there really isn't very much point in showing just movies about how dreadful things are. And we'd like to show a mix. I mean, we cannot avoid the fact that things are bad. You know, species are going extinct. You know, waste is being dumped, you know, children are being affected, you know, all our lives are being affected. But there seems to be a trend towards making movies showing people doing things about it.
The death and destruction seems to be what I'd call a 1970s environmental film message. But what I think has happened is that people have just become so absolutely frustrated because these stories of what can be done and the fact that we can unite and we can work together and make a difference, unfortunately, is never presented in an effective way in the mainstream media. So people are just plain doing it themselves.
Yeah, and that's so wonderful. I mean, the other thing about film festivals in general is that, you know, and certainly ours, you know, many of these filmmakers can't get their films shown anywhere. You know, they're independent filmmakers, and a film festival of this sort is their only venue. And people lap it up. I mean, honestly, we were shocked that the very first film festival where we tried to discourage the filmmakers from coming, a few of them insisted on coming. And we just all of a sudden realized that the audience couldn't get enough of speaking to real experts on the issues. So we've really expanded that. You know, we invite everybody we can.
And quite honestly, a lot of grassroots activists, people who just really care and really want to do something, one of the ways in which activism is expanding out now is through the media.
Oh, yeah.
And house parties and private showings and even presenting this type of media to your local PBS station or
Absolutely.
Whatever else. So this is a place where you can go in on a weekend, really get a sense of what's available, the best that's out there, because nothing works better right now. The media is the message, and that's what we have to do. What a great opportunity for people to just plain spend a weekend and know what's going on.
And it's a wonderful place to meet. I mean, everything is within walking distance. So people are, you know, bumping into each other in the street and saying, what did you just see? Oh, you missed that one. That was so great. Go and see it when it's on tomorrow. And, you know, you should hear the conversations. People are so jazzed about what they're seeing.
So people do show up in Nevada City on Friday. And then are there multiple showings of individual films, or is it pretty well tightly scheduled? Because you have so many different presentations. How should people plan?
They need to plan very carefully. This is one of those things where you can't see everything. We're showing 110 movies, but there's no, you simply can't see them unless you cloned yourself. So you have to, you know, people come with, as soon as the program comes out, people are there with highlighters saying, you know, and trying to pick our brains about which are the best movies and so forth. And what I would say is that we have a subject category list at the end of the program. So you can, if you're particularly interested in one, you know, like forestry or something like that, you can actually plan your weekend around those films. Or if you want to see award winners from other film festivals, we've got all the awards listed after each film. And films that have gotten awards are, it's usually indicative that they are very good. And then, of course, there are the premieres. You know, if you want to be the first one to see a particular film, that's also another way of going about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, again, word of mouth throughout the film festival spreads. And we can't repeat many films, which is sometimes a complaint. But you know, there are just so many good films we can't repeat too often. We're on a limited time scale here.
Well, that's just the way life is. There's no way around that. Yeah.
And the film festival is really put on by a very small skeleton staff of paid people. We have 200 volunteers who put the thing on for real. You know, our tech crew down to bartenders. Everybody is unpaid, and there's a limit to how far we can push our volunteers and how many days we can ask them to work.
Let's talk about films start at what time and how late do they go into the evening?
On Friday, actually, the first thing that's happening is three parties in downtown galleries, and they're free parties just to opening receptions from 4:30 to 6:30. And then from the film start themselves, doors open at 6, and films start in five different screens at 7. And there's music from people like Tuck and Patty, who a lot of people in Northern California will know. People can hear them playing before the film's on Friday night from 6 to 7. And they go till about 10. And, you know, it varies slightly. And then the next day, again, 9:30 all the way through with a few breaks till 10. And then on Sunday, again, it starts at 10, actually. And then we stop for an award ceremony, and then all the award-winning movies are being shown at all four of the venues in the afternoon.
There's also, besides the films, you're going to have the opportunity to meet and talk with the producers, the directors, the screenwriters, et cetera, et cetera. So it's an extraordinary opportunity to learn more and meet on a personal level those people whose passion it is to create these.
Yeah, and a lot of people who are in the movies, people who are featured in those movies, you know, are there too. So before or after a vast majority of the movies, we have we have them up on stage and brief chats. But then on lunchtimes, both on Saturday and Sunday, we basically give everybody lunch to go out and talk to the audience. So all the cafes locally are full of people talking about films.
Well, now, one practical thing for people who want to show up, how about accommodations?
The best way right now is to go to the Nevada City Chamber of Commerce site or to phone us up at 5. I think that we have a link on our website to the Chamber of Commerce site, and there are motels all over the place which are filling up fast.
And then also for people who want to literally find out about the schedule?
Yeah, it's www.wildandscenicfilmfestival.org. And the schedule, right on the homepage, you'll see a link to the schedule and links to how to buy tickets.
And, of course, there is a fee.
Tickets actually range from $5. We have a wonderful kids' environmental sort of cartoon and documentary showing every year. We've had this great popcorn crowd on Saturday mornings. And for that, you can take your kids for just $5. But tickets range all the way up to $220. Probably the best deal is the $82 Wild and Scenic Weekend Pass, which gets you into every venue.
Oh, that's a bargain.
Oh, it's totally a bargain.
I was beginning to think, you know, like, oh boy, I have to take out a loan of my house here, $1,200 or something like that, because some of these film festivals cost you a fortune. That's a bargain.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're trying to get people to watch these movies. We're trying to make it, you know, available to people. And it is an expensive event to put on, so we can't make it, you know, $10 for the weekend, but it's a deal. Yeah, when you look at other film festival prices, this is a major deal.
Now, you've partnered with some major people who've helped you out with this. Why don't you tell us about who's participating in putting on this event?
We've teamed up with a major sponsor. Our title sponsor is Patagonia, the outdoor clothing company, who are truly wonderful people and have a fantastic environmental foundation of their own. And they teamed up with us to put on this home festival, this big festival. And also, when we take this film festival on tour, which we do, we take it throughout the country to activist organizations all over America. And Patagonia has partnered with that, too. The other major sponsor, we have a few other major sponsors, a couple of foundations, and also Environmental Defense, who, if anyone knows what's going on out there in the world of environmentalism these days, Environmental Defense is a leader. Mm-hmm. And so they'll be there in force, too.
Well, definitely talk about the tour, because that's the way this can reach out. If you can't attend the festival can come to you.
Yeah, absolutely. The tour really started a few years ago when people were phoning us up from all over the place saying, how do we put on an environmental film festival? And I basically said, no, we're going to do it for them. And we essentially provide a list of films that they can choose from, and then an entire package on how to put an event on. Essentially, it's a film festival event, but we really wanted to enable small groups to be able to put on events for the rest of their existence. So it comes with a whole package on how to promote an event and how to, you know, write a press release and all that sort of stuff. Because, you know, my theory is you could have the Rolling Stones coming to town, and if you didn't tell anyone about it, no one would come. So, you know, it's terribly important to teach people how to promote and publicize the film festival and any event they put on. So we've probably shown this last year to about 30 places, and next year is going to go up to 50 places. And really, again, they would see something on the website about the tour and how to contact us about mm-hmm. that.
One of the great things that's happening now is the media is really expanding out into the public such that regular folks now can pick up a digital camera,
yep.
a video camera, and get out there and make a difference.
Or they can even do that on their cell phone these days.
That's exactly right.
Yep.
You know, if you're witnessing something or participating someplace, wherever you are, you can actually capture stuff. And then the other side of that as well, and I would guess that this is going to be available, and that is that people can actually buy these DVDs
yes.
and take them home with them.
Absolutely. We encourage filmmakers to send us, you know, 10, 20 of their DVDs, and we have a whole booth set up to sell them.
Well, why don't you go ahead and give us a summary on the event, where it's happening, when?
It's January the 12th to the 14th, in a couple of weeks' time, in Nevada City, California, which is beautiful Northern California. And ticket prices range from $5 to $220. You can buy a weekend pass for a mere $82. And for that, you'll get 110 movies, about 40 premieres, 80 speakers, a wine stroll, VIP parties, opening receptions, art galleries, and loads more.
Sounds like an absolute must. If you can possibly make it, show up. This is the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival, the fifth annual that's happening in Nevada City. We've been talking with Janet Cohen, who is the film festival coordinator. Janet, thanks so much, and have a great and successful weekend.
Well, thanks so much for having us, and we look forward to having some of your listeners come.
Sounds great. Thanks.
Thanks.
It's a lot of creative energy that goes into making films. And a studio on a hill is helping to clear the vision of our past and our future through some highly collaborative work by some very dedicated people. We're heading up to the mountaintop Mecca with Steve Michelson, executive director of the Lobitos Creek Ranch Studio, and learn about Steve's renewed dedication to films of earth and wonder. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.